And a special welcome to the members of the International Board of Governors here from around the world. This year, we are partners with the Royal Society of Canada, which is celebrating its 125th anniversary, and the University of Waterloo, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary, and CG, which is celebrating its 5th anniversary. We're proud of our partner institutions and salute them this morning. Our partnership at this conference focuses on energy, security, and climate change. We are proud to bring together scholars, diplomats, public servants, business persons, and politicians. We're proud to have with us the Minister of Natural Resources and Energy for Canada, the Honourable Gary Lunn, and the Minister of and the Minister of Energy for the Province of Ontario, the Honourable Dwight Duncan. Thank you very much for your presence here today. CG's mandate is to advance the analysis and the public discussion of the most pressing issues of the day. And what issues are more significant than energy, security, and climate change, and the relationship between them? The Royal Society has been honoring Canada's finest scholars for over a century. Those elected represent the finest of Canada's intellectual and scientific tradition. Today, it is my privilege to introduce Professor Patricia Demers, who is the President of the Royal Society of Canada. Dr. Demers is a distinguished scholar of English literature and film studies at the University of Alberta, who was first elected to the Royal Society in 2000. In 2005, she became its president and has taken the lead in renewing and reinvigorating the society. While an outstanding scholar, I was especially pleased to learn that she won the University of Alberta University Cup in 2005 because she was its finest teacher. In addition to her presidential duties, she chairs a task force investigating the place of artists in society. Professor Demers, would you please bring greetings from the Royal Society to this distinguished audience?
Bonjour. Au nom de la Société Royale, SRC, les Académies des Arts, des Lettres et des Sciences du Canada, c'est pour moi un plaisir d'être ici aujourd'hui pour cet événement pendant cette fin de semaine. Je suis ravie de participer en cet événement. I was very honored when fellows at the University of Waterloo, John English, Keith Heiple, and Bruce Mitchell invited me to participate in the organizing committee for this conference. Clearly, from the size of this audience, it is going to be a spectacular and an illuminating event. I look forward to our deliberations, and on behalf of my colleagues in the Royal Society, I wish you every success in your deliberations. Thank you for inviting me to participate today.
Merci, Madame Demers. I'd like to call on John Halliwell, who's a member of our International Board of Governors, who is going to introduce the minister and the succeeding panel. I wanted to say before John comes forward that last evening we participated in the inaugural dinner for the Canadian International Council, which has been organized under the leadership of Jim Bosley. And we had in Toronto 450 people, and Jim and Scott Burke, who I believe is here today, took the lead in raising $3 million for this remarkable new initiative. And its purpose will be to establish research fellowships throughout Canada to work on the most pressing issues in Canadian foreign policy. It is a partnership of CG, the Monk Center at the University of Toronto, the Canadian Institute of International Affairs, the Canadian Institute of Strategic Studies, and other institutes and think tanks and universities throughout Canada. I think we will finally have in Canada a significant body similar to those in other countries that studies the foreign policies of those nations. I would like to thank also Jennifer Jeffs and Neve Perrick and Alison Demui and so many others from CG who did so much work on this project over the last 2 months. They did a terrific job, and I'd like to thank them personally and on behalf of Jim's. Thanks very much. Okay. And with those remarks, I'd like to call on John Halliwell to come forward to introduce the minister.
John, would you like to get the whole panel up here at the beginning?
Why don't we have the
if we could have the whole panel come forward and sit up here. Bienvenue à tous. C'est un grand plaisir d'être ici encore une fois. We've got a highly expert panel of three this morning. There's going to be introductory comments by each panel member, and then we will open to general discussion and questions from the floor. The purpose of this panel is to set the context on energy issues at the global level. We're delighted to have our lead-off speaker being the Honourable Gary Lunn. The documentation distributed to me says he comes from beautiful British Columbia, and as a denizen of the same islands he represents, how can I possibly object to that? It's a great honour for both of us to be here and for me to get the chance to introduce him to you. He's new in the portfolio, but he settled in very quickly and announces it to my great pleasure as a place where people really enjoy working together, and that kind of positive energy is the sort of thing that's going to cause a whole lot of problems to be solved to the extent they are. I'll make an overall comment on that later, but first you really want to hear from the minister. Minister?
Those are always way too high for me. Thank you very much, John. It is a great pleasure to be here. It's nice to have somebody from British Columbia. Of course, we always a big fan of BC. But I also want to bring greetings to, there's a lot of international visitors here. Greetings on behalf of the Government of Canada and extend an official welcome. I'd also like to offer my thanks and congratulations to Jim Balsey, whom, as you all know, without him, this conference would not be taking place. Research in Motion and BlackBerry have done just a great deal to showcase Canada's technology around the world. But the Centre for International Governance and Innovation and the Canadian International Council may well be part of Jim's greatest legacy. Jim and the Centre for International Governance, Innovation, the University of Waterloo, and the Royal Society of Canada have assembled a tremendous meetings of the minds here. We have in this room the type of wisdom, knowledge, experience we need to help us to move closer to this goal. This panel is meant to frame the energy issues as we see them. From where I sit, I see five major challenges facing the global energy system, and none of them will be a surprise to you. First, the geopolitical risks to the energy supply around the world. Second, sustained increases in global demand leading to potential supply challenges themselves. Third, the reliance for years to come on fossil fuels within the global energy mix. Fourth, the reemergence of resource nationalism and its potential to disrupt the markets. And finally, the growth in global energy GHGs. These challenges may impact Canada in different ways, but they are all challenges every single country on this planet will face together. Now, you've heard that Canada is emerging as an energy superpower, and we can play an important role in facing many of these challenges. But unlike many countries, Canada has energy, and we have a lot of it. Canada is emerging, as I said, as an energy superpower. In fact, we are currently the sixth largest producer in the world. We have 14% of the world's proven global oil reserves. Only Saudi Arabia has more. Massive reserves of natural gas, huge coal deposits, the world's largest producer of uranium, and that's only the beginning. We have yet to tap in to the potential energy promise of our Arctic. It won't be long before our energy exports of oil and gas hit $100 billion mark, account for more than 80% of our trade surplus. We're the only country in the OECD whose energy exports are actually increasing, and our open market policies make Canada one of the prime countries to attract foreign investment. We also have to recognize that producing and using fossil fuels accounts for more than 80% of our greenhouse gas emissions. So that's where I really see the prime challenge. I often talk about this as the three E's, and we have to be able to balance all three: the energy, the economy, and the environment. All of us know that you can't move anything in this country without energy. Whether it be people or goods, you need a lot of it. And as I've just stated, energy is contributing both on the production and the consumption side to both the greenhouse gas emissions and our pollutions. And at the same time, energy is the absolute cornerstone that's driving our economy. Some of this people would say this is an enormous challenge. I'm one who believes that you can turn this challenge into an enormous opportunity. We've stated in our recent speech from the throne, we owe it to future generations to take action on climate change so that they will have the same economic prosperity that we have today. Canada's practical balanced plan ensures that we are making real progress. Again, on a common challenge that we all face around the globe. But you need a balanced approach. There's no getting around that, as I said, economies do not move without energy. In fact, you have to be able to have energy if we're going to succeed. So as we try to find the intersection of these three E's on how we're going to move forward to succeed, I want to share a few thoughts on how I believe we should do that. I could talk about the past and, you know, what we've been doing, but I really think it's the future where we need to go. When we took office, I had a hard look in saying, how are we going to find the intersection of these three E's so we can see it in all of them? And I really looked and I said, basically you can boil it down to three areas with respect to energy. Number one, we need to put a lot more clean energy, renewable energy on the grid. We have a lot of opportunities here in Canada. We literally have hundreds of thousands of kilometers of coastline. We're seeing an emergence or just the beginnings of our ocean energy. We've launched the first tidal turbine off the west coast of Canada, which is now producing energy. Enormous potential in wind, biomass. There's just a lot of potential. So that's one way. We need to put a lot more clean energy. But at the same time, we also recognize that renewable energy today and our total energy mix is about a half of 1%. So we have to be realistic and recognize, you know, we need to make progress. There's great opportunities there, but it's still a relatively small part of energy mix. Secondly, we have to become a lot more energy efficient. There's no question about that. Energy efficiency, our consumption, you know, you just look at the amount of energy that we consume. I absolutely fundamentally believe that the largest untapped source of energy in this country is the energy that you and I waste every day. It's larger than the oil sands. It's larger than anything else that we have. And lastly, the third one we have to look at and one I want to focus a little bit on is we need to use technology to clean up our conventional energy. It's absolutely going to be key. Technology is going to play a role. In fact, technology is going to play a role as we emerge as an energy superpower and we transgress that into emerging as a clean energy superpower in all three of these disciplines, when you think about it. The technologies that are driving the renewable energy in every single discipline that are emerging around we're seeing in every single corner. On energy efficiency, just to put everything that you touch and feel comes back to technology. Earlier this year, my colleague, the Minister of Environment, and I, we moved to bring in standards for lighting. And some people come up to me and said, you know, lighting, come on, guys, like, we have to get serious. But just think about lighting. 5% of all the energy we consume in North America is in lighting. We have the ability to reduce that amount of energy by up to 80% on a whole number of facets but it's all technology related. Everything from our transportation systems, the evolution of hybrid vehicles, and they're becoming better and better all the time. The use of hydrogen. We now have car makers. They're now making vehicles that run on hydrogen, commercially available today. On Parliament Hill, we run some of the buses are running on hydrogen around Parliament Hill. Audi has a car out that you can buy today that runs on hydrogen. So again, technology is going to be key. But where I really think the opportunity is going to be significant is on the conventional side with technology. Something close to 80% of the world's energy supply is coming from fossil fuels today. You think about that and where we have to go. And we have a great opportunity here in Canada to be a global leader on these technologies. Things like clean coal technology and carbon sequestration. We have the technology today to produce energy from coal that is virtually 100% pollution-free. They can take out virtually all of the pollutants out of the stack, the NOx, the SOx, the particulate matter, all of it. And you combine that with sequestration, you can have a very clean form of energy. And we have thousands of years of supplies of coal here in Canada and around the globe. Why I believe the emergence of these technologies is so fundamentally importantly is when you look at the big picture. And our Prime Minister, when he was in Australia earlier this year at APEC, talked about the importance of bringing all the countries in if we're really going to have an impact. That's going to be the solution if we're going to really make a difference on the environment and on the reduction of greenhouse gases. He made that very clear. You look at countries like China that are putting 1,000 megawatts of new energy on the grid every 10 to 14 days. And it's primarily coal. 80% of their energy is coal. I believe you'll see in the very short order significant clean coal projects here in Canada with full sequestration, something our government's committed to. So it's, again, I absolutely believe technology is going to play a role. Another form is on nuclear. We're seeing an emergence of nuclear energy around the globe and here in Canada, something we haven't seen for decades. It's been more than 25 years since we've seen a new nuclear plant built in Canada, even longer in the United States, and we're seeing increased interest here in Canada. New Brunswick is talking about, they've got a feasibility study out. We know Ontario is talking about new energy from nuclear. 50% of Ontario's electricity today is from nuclear. It's emission-free. It's emission-free, and it's greenhouse gas-free. And if you look at where the technology is evolving again on the Gen 4, it'll be able to extract even more of the energy out of the uranium and be able to reprocess the fuel more efficiently, reducing the amount of waste. So again, I think technology is key on all of these disciplines. That's how we're really going to leave our mark. And again, it really comes back full circle. You look at what Jim Balsi's been able to do with RIM and that technology. I travel around the globe. I don't go into a boardroom. I'm sitting on a plane at 39,000 feet, and you can hear the BlackBerries going off. They're in every boardroom, every place. It had such a dramatic impact, and we need to take almost that level and try to transform that kind of technology innovation around the world. And again, with our energy resources, I believe we absolutely have the ability to do that in every single discipline of energy. So with that, I just, again, I know there's an enormous amount of brain trust in this room, brain power, and it's innovators like you, the people that are going to make this happen. We as governments can only create the conditions so that we can emerge, but it's people like you and working with governments that are going to make that happen. So, again, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my vision as we move forward. I'll just conclude with one note. We saw that in the front page of the National Post to reinforce this theme. And it's, you know, you're all aware of the scientific journal Nature. And they talked yesterday about the way we're going to succeed on the environment, on the climate change file, is going to be technology. They talked about having to see a massive increase in spending at a wartime footing, and literally the tens of billions of dollars. So again, I want to wish you a very successful 2 days in your conference. It's been a pleasure to share my thoughts with you, and I will look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister, for setting a very hopeful context. The next two speakers are going to give you some global background to set the context for the more general discussions. There's a very natural flow from the Minister's reference to carbon use and coal into Thomas Homer Dixon and his discussions of precisely these issues at the global level. I'm shortcutting the very large and impressive CVs of our speakers, which are in your books, in order to give them more time to speak.
Thank you, John. It's marvelous to be here, and I'm just thrilled that we're seeing CG and other institutions begin to focus on these issues with the deliberation and urgency that's required. I'm going to cut to the chase. I don't have a lot of time. I'd like to get a number of issues on the table right away. This is a high-level audience. I'm going to assume that you're pretty familiar with a lot of these things. I have 5 points to make. And the first is that as you can see, we are probably near the peak global output of conventional oil. The second is that the energy costs of conventional and unconventional oil and natural gas are rising fast. This trend appears to be driving a recarbonization of the global fuel supply. I agree entirely with the Minister that carbon capture and storage is therefore a sine qua non technology. It's a critical technology if humankind is going to avoid catastrophic climate change. And then finally, China is an enormous actor in this situation. China's rapid, large-scale implementation of CCS is unfortunately unlikely, although it's absolutely essential in the near to medium term. And that's the point I will conclude with. Let's go through these points individually fairly quickly. On the first point, most of you are probably familiar with the general peak oil hypothesis. It's receiving more attention now than it has in the past. Peak oil people, and I have for a while counted myself in that camp, have been regarded as kooks for quite a while. But interestingly enough, the evidence seems to be increasingly supporting the suggestion that we are at or near the peak of global conventional oil production. Two reports this last summer spoke about oil supply constraints, conventional oil supply constraints. The National Petroleum Council report and the International Energy Agency midterm outlook for oil both discussed peak oil in general terms and suggested that this is a perspective that has to be given real consideration now. ExxonMobil and other majors not long ago suggested that non-OPEC production would probably peak within the next 5 to 8 years. The issue now is when OPEC production will peak, and that really boils down to Saudi Arabia. Let me just explain what you're looking at in this particular chart. We're looking at a chart of oil discovery around the planet going back to 1900. On the left axis, you've got a scale going up to 60 billion barrels of oil equivalent. And across the bottom, from 1900 to 2005, you can see that oil discovery, and again, these are ExxonMobil data, peaked around 1960 and has declined pretty well steadily since then, with a couple of reversals, the most important in the 1970s, relating to discovery of North Sea oil and the Alaska North Slope oil. Oil consumption or production is increasing at around 1.5 to 3% a year, largely driven by increasing consumption in China and India. And of course, the thing you've noticed immediately about this particular chart is what's happening on the right-hand side. On an annual basis, we're consuming about 30 billion barrels of oil, and we're discovering between 3 and 10 billion barrels. In 2005, we discovered 3 billion. In 2006, apparently, we discovered about 4 billion. So we are consuming 5, 6, 7 times more oil on an annual basis than we are discovering. That can go on for a while, but we're tapping into very large oil fields that were discovered a long time ago. Eventually, global oil production is going to peak and start to decline. We don't know exactly when. It depends critically on what's happening in Saudi Arabia, and of course Saudi Arabia does not release its reserve figures. They have been claiming they have 260 billion barrels of oil for the last 17 years. That figure hasn't changed despite the fact that they produced about 50 billion barrels of oil in that period of time. There are a lot of reasons to be suspect about the Saudi figures, and there's evidence now that their largest field, Ghawar, has peaked and is starting to decline. What happens on the far side of peak whenever it occurs, and I think it will happen within the next 10 years, will depend largely on the rate of decline. If you look at oil-producing regions around the world, the rate varies between about 3% to 12% a year. Oman's major oil field right now is declining at 12% a year. It's very fast. The average is about 8% a year. If it's 3%, we probably can manage. We can compensate by using heavy oil and non-conventional sources and perhaps ramping up coal production. If it's 8% to 12%, we're going to have very substantial price shocks in the global economy. Most giant oil fields were discovered a long time ago. In fact, the four biggest in the world, as you can see from this chart, were discovered in the 1950s, pre-1950s in the 1950s, and one in the 1970s. I hope you can see these figures, but the trend line here that you want to notice impressionistically is that we are discovering smaller pools of oil. In general, we're drilling deeper, going farther into more hostile environments to discover smaller pools of lower quality oil. And the best way of thinking about this shift is in terms of what energy specialists call the energy return on investment. Producing energy costs energy. And you may have already heard of this concept, the energy return on investment. In the 1930s in Texas, drillers got back about 100 barrels of oil for every barrel of oil they invested to drill down into the ground and pump oil out. The energy return on investment in the United States for conventional oil right now is around 17 to 1. The EROI for the tar sands, considered by many Americans to be the backstop energy source for the United States when conventional oil starts to become much more costly, is around 4 to 1. As we slide down that slope from 100 to 1 to 17 to 1 to 4 to 1 towards 1 to 1, we're using a larger and larger fraction of the capital and the wealth in our economies simply to produce energy, and we've got less left over for everything else we want to do. This is a critical problem we face, and I think it has not been fully grasped. We're going through a transition in coming decades from a regime of abundant, high-quality, high EROI, EROI energy characterized by abundant petroleum to one of abundant, mixed quality, often low EROI energy. And I'll just make this point by putting some more data up on the screen. These are from Cutler Cleveland at Boston University. And what you're seeing here, comparative EROIs for different fuel systems. Across the bottom, you have on the left-hand side, crude oil. We'll come back to coal in a minute. Gasoline, corn ethanol, oil shale, and coal liquefaction. Crude oil is at 20 to 1 in the United States. It's falling, and that number is declining quite quickly. Look at corn ethanol. It's about 1 to 1. You put in about as much energy as you get back. Oil shale and tar sands are around 4 to 1. Coal liquefaction, which means turning coal into diesel, has a terrible EROI. The one thing that stands out here, of course, is that coal itself is still giving us an enormous return in energy per unit energy invested. And that is one of the key messages I want to get across today. what we're seeing fundamentally as oil prices are rising, and as the energy cost of oil, conventional oil, is rising, we're seeing a shift back to carbon-rich fuels, especially coal and especially unconventional sources like the tar sands, which produce an enormous amount of carbon for every unit of energy produced. There's been a historical trend of the decarbonization of energy. What we're seeing right now is quite a significant shift. The historical trend from wood to coal to petroleum to oil to natural gas has been to produce more and more energy for less outputs of carbon or less carbon content in the fuel. Here we have a graph showing the decline historically and then some projections from the late 1990s into the future. All of those different lines are various computer model projections. Let's take a specific look at the period of time from 1980 to 2002. Here we see that actually there hasn't been much decline over that period of time in the ratio of carbon to energy. There hasn't been much decarbonization of fuels. The gains that we've seen in carbon output per unit energy carbon output per GDP are almost entirely derived from improvements in efficiency, energy efficiency. So that declining light purple line, energy / GDP, that ratio, is what's driving the overall change in declining carbon intensity. We're actually not seeing, in recent decades, we have not seen a shift in any respect globally to less carbon-intensive fuels. It may actually be the case now that we're seeing a shift backwards. In fact, the evidence is strong that we are seeing this. We see this here in increasing CO2 concentrations on an annual basis in the most distant part of the world, in the Antarctic, where the atmosphere is very thoroughly mixed. Now, you can divide this list of figures up in various ways and produce different averages. I've done it in a way to highlight what seems to be a trend here, which is towards increasing concentrations of carbon dioxide, increasing increments, larger and larger increments of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere on an annual basis. The consensus is that this is significantly driven by increasing petroleum prices and fuel switching to coal and, for instance, to tar sands energy. It may also, evidence is emerging, be driven, these increases may be driven by the fact that some sinks are becoming saturated, especially the capacity of the Southern Ocean around Antarctica to absorb carbon dioxide. But the consensus is that the major thing that seems to be driving the increase in atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, these larger and larger increments, and we seem to be moving towards 3 parts per million a year now, is a shift to coal. So let's talk for a couple of minutes about coal. Coal provides over 25% of the world's primary energy. It provides 40% of the world's electricity. Coal extraction grew at around 5% per year between 2000 and 2005, which corresponds to a doubling time of 14 years. 90% is consumed in the country of origin, which makes it very different from petroleum, which is shipped all over the planet. Coal produces nearly 40% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, mainly carbon dioxide. We're not going to get ourselves out of this problem unless we move in very substantial way to carbon capture and storage. And I want to echo what the minister has said. I'd urge you to take a close look at this report from MIT earlier this year, The Future of Coal. What they're saying here is that we need to invest very substantial resources in moving this technology ahead as quickly as possible. It is a critical technology. It is a sine qua non technology, as I call it. The front-end investments are not as huge as you might think. We need about $1 billion to identify reservoirs around the planet, to survey them, to test them out, and find out what quality are places where we can potentially store carbon dioxide. And we need $1 to $2 billion to ramp up some serious tests, because we need to run those tests for about half a dozen years, maybe 8 years, before we know really what happens underground in terms of percolation of carbon dioxide underground. That investment, though, even that relatively modest investment, is not yet on the table, even in the United States. we need to think carefully about the scale of what we're undertaking here. This is going to be an absolutely enormous technological undertaking. Sequestering just 1 billion tons of carbon per year requires injection of 50 million barrels per day of supercritical CO2 from about 600 1,000 megawatt coal plants. Now, that's only about an eighth of the carbon dioxide that we're dumping into the atmosphere on an annual basis. This is going to be this is going to be an enormous, enormous capital investment and technological undertaking. And I agree entirely with the statement in Nature over the last few days that suggests that what we really need to deal with this problem is to move to the kind of mobilization of resources that we would see during a war. My final comments are just on China. China is a very significant actor, as we all recognize. Coal accounts for two-thirds of China's primary energy supply. It's doubled its output in the last 5 or 6 years, from about a ton per person to now it's about, actually these figures need to be revised, to about 2.7 billion tons per year, or about 2 tons per person, which is about one-third of the total world coal output. Over half of this coal is used to generate electricity, and 80% of China's electricity comes from coal. About 70,000 megawatts of new generating capacity was brought online in 2005. That's equivalent to England's entire electricity generating capacity. And that was just about all coal. Nearly 50% of China's railway capacity is dedicated to moving coal. And the problem here is that even if China decides, the regime decides to get on board with carbon capture and sequestration and really engage in a global agreement and commit to a global agreement to control and then ramp down human carbon emissions, it's not clear that they're going to be able to make the regions and localities in China go along. And this is, I think, the most profound statement, the most important argument in this report from MIT. China's energy development is largely driven by decisions at the local level, and these decisions are largely driven by commitment, an overwhelming commitment to maintaining growth and maintaining employment at the local level. So the Chinese government's capacity, as this report says, to achieve targets for reducing hydrocarbon consumption and reducing carbon dioxide emissions is actually quite limited. And I just want to highlight that last sentence in this, extracted from this report, that it is an illusion to expect that the world's carbon problem can somehow be solved by wholesale changes in Chinese energy and emissions policies. I'm not sure, frankly, what the answer to this situation is, but I come to a recognition that the situation in China probably requires more than simply a regime commitment, which we don't have fully yet, that we might actually need more general political, deeper political and democratic reform in the country for the really substantial policy changes that are necessary to come to the fore. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. There's once again, I think, a natural link between his presentation on the physical side to Steve Strongen of Goldman Sachs, who's going to round out the policy context, and then we'll open up for discussion.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. One small confession. I am an economist. The traditional role in meetings such as this for the economists is to explain that if you close your hand and wait for Adam Smith's invisible hand to take care of it, all of these problems will likely go away. I think in the seriousness of what we actually face and the issues, a slightly different role is probably more useful and necessary. One of the traditional issues that we face in dealing with energy policies is that the law of unintended consequence, which is the government action, tends to lead to a different outcome than the intention, is a very important one. And I think as we look at how it is we have to address the challenges, and the quite obvious challenges that are here, it's important to have an understanding of what the actual economic background is, of what solutions are likely to work, which ones likely to fail, and which ones are likely to backfire. to get a better sense of where energy, political energy, intellectual energy is best spent. Typically, the head-on approach to these problems has not worked, and fairly graphically has not worked. They have gotten worse over the years. The first time I analyzed an energy policy problem was in the late 1970s, which was the first time people were forecasting $100 oil. At that time, however, the primary climate issue was a concern that smog was going to generate a new ice age, as opposed to carbon was going to generate global warming. I think the science is somewhat better this time than it was that time. But these issues remain complex, they remain dynamic, and they have a way of changing shape and form as we look at them. And the response to policy is often very subtle. In my own case, the moment I remember most clearly was in the winter of 2000. We faced what at the time was considered an energy shortage and a massive increase in energy prices to what now seems the rather low level of $36. And this was deemed sufficient to generate a fairly strong policy response and essentially, in a realistic sense, one of the only times the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, have been used to release energy to the markets. The administration was incredibly concerned about what would happen during the winter. 10 million barrels was released. The market instantly dropped $6, a successful policy action. The problem, in truth, was it closed the arb between Europe and the U.S. All of a sudden, there was no oil coming. Ships literally turned around in the middle of the Atlantic and went back the other way. At the end, there was 30 million barrels less oil in the United States rather than 10 more. And the winter actually proved to be somewhat problematic from a public policy standpoint. I think as we look at the problems we face, there's a couple of key junctures to think about. In general, attacks on production fail. The reason they fail is that they tend to move production to places that are more friendly to carbon, to energy usage. So the classic example used is that if you tax the production of carbon in Canada, in the United States, you will move the production to China, where the carbon will actually increase rather substantially. When we approach consumption as the key issue, it tends to work better. In the sense that if you stop the consumption, you truly have stopped it, but not on a barrel-for-barrel basis. Because typically what has happened is you have lowered prices. Those prices encourage consumption elsewhere. And you have damped flexibility in the system. One of the things that Europe believed for decades was that their high taxes on energy would make them more resilient to high energy prices in the United States, which had failed to have a coherent energy policy, in their view. In truth, what it did is it gave the U.S. a cost advantage. It, in essence, saved oil so that the U.S. could consume it. And then when oil prices went up, the U.S. had actually significant amounts of consumption that were far easier to reduce. So that the policy implications in Europe were actually worse rather than easier than they were in the United States. So again, the perversity of response made the action less effective than it otherwise might have been because it was done too locally. So in that sense, I think it's very important to, one, think about the consumption end of this rather than production, which runs into the politics, of course, that it's much more attractive to put the burden, in essence, on corporations than people. But the burdens on corporations have a tendency to move away and disappear. So in the end, it probably has to actually be on people. It is us who has to consume less, not the corporations who have to adjust at that level. If we adjust, they will. Secondly, when we think about consumption, it needs to be thought about globally, or we tend to displace the consumption rather than end it. Although, in general, that is more successful in ways of saving, truly saving. Things like light bulb standards, the little stuff, actually can really reduce consumption. Although, again, the reduction in price does tend to dissipate it. The third general area, which is the most subtle but also the most important, is technology. Technology is always pointed to as a solution. And there are lots of good examples of that being the case. But when we think about government, when we think about wartime efforts, I think the key thing to understand is for that to work sustainably, it is at the level of development that policy tends to work. It is not at the level of adaption. What do I mean by that? When we build and create technologies that are truly economically efficient, they spread themselves. Right? You don't need a government policy to help. They will move quickly because they will become a competitive advantage. You don't need to worry about global cooperation because the advantage of the technology itself will create the cooperation. When we talk about technologies that are economically inefficient, where use requires subsidy, we inevitably end up with situations where we invest more energy than we get out. We end up with situations where we twist production systems in rather odd ways, where we turn a gasoline shortage into a food shortage, our most recent example. These don't tend to work that well. On the other hand, when we create new technologies, we create jobs, we create a force for change that lasts a very long time. The problem with that, which is not a real problem, but is a problem of expectations, is that for new technologies to work, and to work economically, you actually have to cross the point of true economic efficiency. And the reality of those points is sometimes less than appetizing from a realistic standpoint. Probably the most recent example of this is hybrid cars. We tend to think of gasoline prices as being pretty high right now. They've been a lot higher in Europe for a long time because of taxation, and it hasn't really massively changed the way they drive. The prices at which that occurs are quite a bit higher than the ones we're now experiencing. But those set of technologies become economically efficient at prices that are higher than these. We don't like that answer. But whether we like it or not, it is the answer. Technologies move and create themselves when they actually do offer an economic advantage. One of the reasons you see hybrids spreading into the high end of cars, right, jumping the middle, is the people in the middle actually buy cars to use, right? At the high end, you can sell someone a social principle, right? But in the middle, it actually has to work for them. And the middle is what really matters. And so as we think about the possibilities that we're examining today from a policy standpoint, as we think about the challenges we all face, it is important to realize we face them globally, and we can't ignore the economics. And in fact, if we do it right, the economics becomes our friend. Because an economically efficient and export-driven solution, something that actually gives you an advantage, right, solves all of the horrible, terrible global cooperation problems that infect this issue. Right? Because as soon as there's a true economic advantage, you don't even have to hold a meeting. But while it is a true cost, getting that cooperation is incredibly difficult, if possible at all. Particularly when you use that economic issue of present value, when the problems are uncertain and tomorrow, and the costs are certain and today, getting that cooperation has never proved to be really feasible. On the other hand, when the savings are today, you have a very different issue. So as we think about the possibilities, as we think about the allocation of our own effort, what I would urge is focusing on the consumption end and on the true development of technology and not on forcing the answer, because the force will prove to be enormously difficult in the end unless it actually works for the people doing it. That's the end of my comments, and I think we're opening this now for questions. Absolutely.
Thank you to all the panelists for setting a context with basically all the dimensions in it. Now's the time for you to ask questions to draw on their expertise more deeply. Has somebody got a microphone for questioners? If you could state your name and where you're from, that would be helpful.
Hi, my name's Keith Honeyborn. I'm with the Alliance for Clean Technology. My question is actually for Thomas Wilmer Dixon. When you talked about the energy return on investment for coal, I wonder if you have any idea what it might be if you did include the cost of carbon sequestration.
Right.
And in that, I think there's also some geological issues, which is whether it's feasible to actually sequester it in local areas or in areas which are close to the actual coal plants, and what the cost might be for that.
These are good questions. Just to repeat, because some people may have heard had trouble hearing. What is the impact on the coal EROI of CCS? And is it the case that we have sufficient reservoirs near where coal is produced or where you might build the coal-fired power plants? From what I understand, the energy cost of CCS is entirely manageable. We're talking at something about 10%. So we reduce the average 80 EROI to say something like 60 or 70. So it's still a huge advantage. In terms of the second question, there are places in the world that are geographically and geologically advantaged, where coal is located close to reservoirs, and you could potentially build very large zero-emission power plants in those places where you gasify the coal, pump the coal, carbon dioxide underground, have a pure stream of hydrogen that you can use as a, for instance, transportation fuel. Alberta happens to be one of the places in the world where the geology just lines up right across the board. And so it turns out that Canada, and again I agree with the minister here, can be a world leader in this technology. When a new administration comes in the States and the United States decides to make the kind of mega commitment that it's capable of making to the development of these technologies, Canada will quite likely be left in the dust. We have a relatively small window of time here to get ahead of this issue in terms of R&D and technological development and put ourselves on the map as world leaders with CCS technology and then sell it around the planet. And Alberta happens to be a terrifically good place to do this. I've been saying this for about 5 or 6 years now. And there are other places in the world, including in China and India, where you've got very large coal reserves and what appear to be good reservoirs for carbon dioxide. But I suspect you're a little bit skeptical, and skepticism is warranted. We need to do a lot of research about reservoir characteristics, about the long-term capacity to keep this stuff underground, and we need to get going with that research right away. Just to reinforce one point that I was making, I've talked to energy experts around the world, and almost without exception, they say, if we can't do this, we are in serious trouble. If we don't get CCS working, we're in serious trouble.
Thank you very much. Right here, there's the next question.
Hello, Annette Hester from CG. Thank you very much for setting the framework, question and a comment. Thomas, did you include, what happens when you include the actual usage of carbon for increased production in conventional, which has proven, Weyburn has, we have very good success in Canada in including that in the technology. So that's one comment. The second, if I may, to Steve, I was actually surprised in a way at some of the comments and although I completely agree with the fact that we have to look at demand, the fact that there was one mention of the United States and its voracious appetite for energy and its lack of responsibility in not approving any legislation, even CAFE standards. I mean, nothing that will curb and address the demand issue. Although you single out demand, you don't mention the United States, and I think that can't be an elephant in the room. Thank you.
I just want to, if you don't mind, just bring the microphone back for a second. I just want to clarify the first question. I didn't get it entirely.
What I meant is when you talk about carbon sequestration storage, I generally, when I talk about it, and I completely agree with what's been said in the panel, is I talk about carbon sequestration usage and storage, so that we don't just turn carbon into storage, but we look at way of using it productively in order to boost our conventional production.
Okay, well, just to explain to people in the audience then, in many cases, in fact, in some of the tests, as you mentioned, Weyburn and Saskatchewan, tests in the world right now, we're using carbon dioxide, we're pumping it underground in order to force oil to the surface in reservoirs that are largely depleted. Again, in Alberta, we might be able to do this in many places. We might be able to put carbon dioxide underground and use it to force both oil and natural gas to the surface and increase production from what are otherwise depleted, largely depleted reservoirs. It kind of defeats the purpose, though, when you do that. You're putting carbon dioxide underground and you're producing more hydrocarbons that you're going to burn and release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Ideally, what you want to do, and this is why I talked about these zero-emission coal plants, is you want to take the coal out of the ground. And you can also potentially do this right underground with coal gasification underground. You take the coal out of the ground, you gasify it, you strip out a pure stream of carbon dioxide and a pure stream of hydrogen. You pump all of the carbon back underground, 100%, and then you use the hydrogen as a transportation fuel, and you burn it, and you're not producing any greenhouse gases. The problem, for instance, I'll just put this in context. In the tar sands in Alberta, if the tar sands invest in CCS in a major way for their production process, you're still producing gasoline and diesel that is used in transportation vehicles and releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The kind of zero-emission coal-fired power plant, gasified coal plant that I'm talking about, would actually produce no emissions anywhere in the stream of energy use down the line to the final user. That's a significant accomplishment. Just on your second point, I'm not sure whether it was addressed to me or to all the panelists, but very quickly, I think one thing we haven't mentioned here, which is very important, and I think Steve will have lots to say about this, is getting carbon markets operating well continentally and globally, and then getting a substantial price on carbon through perhaps some kind of cap and trade mechanism. If we get an MIT coal study says we are not going to get substantial investment in CCS until we have $30 a ton on coal. A lot of people are saying it needs to go substantially higher than that, but if we at least had $30 a ton on coal and it was predictable, and we had a carbon market in which we could trade the rights to emit around the world, and it was verifiable, then we would see a surge of entrepreneurship on this issue.
As an American who spends a great deal of time not in the United States, I make a point of not attempting to explain American policy. It doesn't work very well. I think the one thing I would say, and it's a broader point, is that in general, when governments attempt to make people behave better, whether it's CAFE standards or anything else, it's tended to have pretty minimal effects. We can argue about whether it's good for principle in its own sake or not. And you know, from a personal politics standpoint, I'd probably actually be quite happy to see them much higher. But from the standpoint of addressing any of the problems we're talking about, the reality is that the price is what has to be higher. It's not a question. One of the issues when we talk about many of the conservation efforts is the notion is somehow by that way we can consume less energy without it being painful. And the reality is that you'll simply get new sources of consumption that will absorb the energy that would have been consumed elsewhere. We have essentially an infinite capacity to absorb energy over time, whether it be geographic expansion into the emerging markets, so that from a, call it a moral perspective, I have tremendous sympathy with the notion of improving those policies. From the standpoint of whether they address the issues that we have come here to address, I actually think they don't do very much. And the reason they don't do very much is because right now the only thing that is limiting consumption is available supply. And the only thing we are doing at the margin is determining who consumes it. And so that when we look at the problem, it has to be addressed more fundamentally than that. We have to find ways of creating energy that generate an entirely different level of environmental impact. We have to find ways of changing the underlying economics in a pretty substantial way. One of the things that gets missed in these discussions is that from a pure energy standpoint, the problem is actually considerably smaller than the one we outline. What do I mean by that? Well, if you actually looked at available energy, it's actually a lot higher than the typical estimates that are used. The reason we can't get to that energy is that typically we can't move it to where we could consume it. It would, for instance, be quite easy to generate a lot of wind power in the middle of Siberia. Okay? You, however, couldn't actually get any of it anywhere where you could consume it. We have some of the similar issues with tidal power. A lot of the fundamental issues are actually about transportation and finding ways of moving energy more cheaply. One of the issues, for instance, in nuclear power and biomass is that one of the things we may end up doing in the end is using nuclear power to process cellulitic so that you can move it and not have to have it next to major cities. Right? The solutions are likely to be pretty complicated. They are also likely to require very different prices. Because in the end, you're going to reduce consumption because prices are high, or you're going to have found technologies that make the impact of creating the energy lower. Those are the only two answers that actually change the answer. Everything else just shifts where you have the problem. And I may have, personally, significant moral opinions about where I think those burdens should be. They don't actually address the problem, however. They address a social question of where the burden of solving the problem should fall, which is a different thing. I know you don't like that answer, but I am still an economist.
Minister, and then I'll get back to the questions out there.
Just really briefly, on the, and you made the comment, the lack of responsibility by the U.S. Before we say that, I think we all need to have a hard look at ourselves, too, on the entire spectrum. We're all in this together. And I think we need to look at ourselves and what we can do. And I think there is a great opportunity. Are the economics there? We talked a lot about clean coal, and I agree. I think there's an enormous opportunity because you can get to zero emission. The technology is available. The economics are not quite there. But if you actually compare the economics to a new build on a nuclear reactor, on what it would cost today, on a new hydroelectric dam, on how much it's costing to produce a barrel of oil, the economics are getting very close. I absolutely believe you will see clean coal projects. You're seeing a few of them now in the world. I actually think you'll start seeing retrofits of existing plants, which is really where you need to go. We talk about the amount of new plants coming on in countries like China. We're going to have to retrofit these plants, and they're coming. I'll just, my last point, And Canada has an opportunity to be a leader, and I'm convinced we will, pushing this, but I don't see it as a competition with any other country. This problem is so global, it's so big, we're all in it together. We need to share information, we need to welcome every country, whether it's United States, and there should be, obviously their intellectual property and the people are making the investments, but we need to move beyond that to make the fastest and greatest gains we can. And the opportunity is there. We just have to have the will to do it.
As the minister suggests, almost everything in this needs sharing except the blame. The next question was back there. I think it's your... Yeah. No, you got it.
Thank you. I'm Colin Bradford from Brookings and from CG, in fact. And the fact that we're at CG leads me to ask all of you a governance question. There are 2 billion people in a world of 6 billion people today who don't have access to electricity. Most demographers think that in 2050 we will have 3 billion more people in the world. 3 plus 2 equals 5 billion people who will be new claimants for electricity in 2050, And in the electricity era of the last century, we have produced electricity for only four. So this question, in a way, I'm particularly interested in all of your answers, but to Steve Strongen, who presides over and looks into the investment analysis at Goldman Sachs. When you think of the scale of investment that is required to meet the potential claimants for energy in the future, we are talking about a massive scale, an unprecedented scale of investment. Those investments are lumpy, they are long-term, and they are interconnected. Externalities, which economics is not good at handling, are the quintessential nature of these investments. The question I have for you is, given this scenario, how is it possible to leave it to markets, which is what the economists and Steve, I think, would like to do, when in fact what the need is for coordination and cooperation to supplement markets to deal with this problem, to prevent the externalities of this scale of investment from colliding with each other and causing disruptions and disturbances both in the markets and socially that could have been prevented by a more coordinated mechanism? I want to sit down, but the question is, there is a void, if I'm correct, in the energy sector in the world, in that there is no single focal point now for global energy governance. Doesn't that void need to be addressed? That's the question.
We've got several more questioners on the list, and we're running out of time. If we could, Brian,
I'll give you a very quick answer, and since I'm going to end it on a political note, I will turn it over to the minister very quickly, if I can. You know, there's a classic economic theorem on sort of where markets fail. The answer is it's where property rights are not well assigned. And in truth, if you look at the current problem, it fits perfectly on two fronts. From a development of resources standpoint, it is the issue that a private company developing or putting $1 trillion into Iran or Russia doesn't necessarily feel secure with that investment. Or Venezuela, probably even more pointedly. And that the risk issues around that are significant, and the ability to predict the property rights of those developments is one of the things that is stopping development of the known resources, and probably is more responsible for the peak in oil production than the physics. The second part of it is the property rights around carbon. We have not penalized people for, in essence, creating a problem in the commons because no one owns the damage and therefore can't sue for damages. So it's a second legal problem. And you're right. It's clearly an issue of global coordination since both of those things are very much cross-border. One of the reasons the problems in the 70s were so easy in comparison to today's is that Norway invested in Norway, and the U.S. invested in Alaska, and Canada invested in Canada, and the U.K. invested in the U.K., and you produced a lot of oil. And when you look at it today, the big consuming countries don't have the obvious places to invest outside of Canada. And that poses a significant political problem. You probably could solve the energy problem, not the carbon problem, but the energy problem in about 2 hours with a UN treaty that specified the property rights on the development of oil fields globally. However, the odds of you actually getting anyone to do anything, right, and actually sign that document are probably zero. I'm starting with the United States' refusal to participate. You could then roll on to all the other countries that would fail to participate for various reasons. You know, you're right, but that isn't going to be the answer. And so the challenge is more, how do you get an economic solution that can deal with the political intransigence of global cooperation? Because I think the probability that you can get to a global war footing, at least before the problems become clearly short-term catastrophic, is probably too small to represent a meaningful avenue of useful energy.
Well, I'm not going to even try to answer the functionality of the UN and how we'd get that through in 2 hours, but some of the people in the room might have some better answers. But, you know, if you look historically at how we consume energy around the globe, you know, it very much we're constrained in geographic regions, North America. We didn't have an ability to move energy around the world easily not that long ago. That's changing rapidly. with the emergence of LNG. We're seeing that around the globe. And you're seeing a lot more of that. Obviously, we've been able to move oil around the globe. But I think you're going to see a much more integrated global energy market, which, you know, there's an opportunity for organizations like the OECD, the International Energy Agency, to play a role in moving that coordination. I don't disagree with you. There's a lot of opportunity there. And not just on the coordination of energy, but everything on the challenges on the environment, on the consumption. You just think about the amount of oil we consume on the planet every day. 80 to 85 million barrels of oil every single day. You have to ask yourself if that's sustainable. And clearly it's not. It's not sustainable. And so I don't disagree. You know, we need to be a lot more proactive in our coordination around the globe. And I think with the integration with the emerging economies like China, and it has to happen. But it's going to take the will to push it that way.
I'd say one more response from Tom. Then
very quickly, I think it's a terrific question. I don't want the equity issue to get lost. Those 5 billion people you're talking about, the 2.4 billion people living on $2 a day or less on the planet. Traditionally, conventionally, in the past, we've learned that those kinds of equity problems have to be addressed through government and through the creation of institutions to compensate for market failures. I'm a huge fan of markets and getting prices that motivate entrepreneurship. But markets themselves are created by institutions, and we need powerful global institutions here that can create the public good of, for instance, a global carbon market to allow that entrepreneurship to flourish. I don't see this as an either-or situation. You create the institutional environment, and you get the markets operating, and you get the entrepreneurship. The silver lining in this cloud may be that it creates an integrated set of global institutions that allow humankind over the long term to manage its affairs much more effectively.
Good question. There you go.
Scott Lockquist Morgan. I'm with the Canadian Center for Treaty Compliance, Carleton University. My question is for Thomas Homer-Dixon. Probably require just the briefest of responses. My question is this. In respect of the chart comparing the EROIs, I was wondering where you would place nuclear power and what its EROI is.
Well, that's a question I've been trying to get Cutler to answer for a long time at Boston University, and he keeps avoiding my phone calls on this. It's a tough question. And with all of these EROI calculations, the issue is how you bound the system. The boundaries always tend to be quite arbitrary. What do you include as part of the energy stream that goes into producing the energy, and what do you leave out? With a nuclear plant, for instance, do you include all of the energy that goes into constructing the plant? Do you include all of the energy that goes into extracting and refining the uranium fuel? And fundamentally, do you include all of the energy yet to be spent on dealing with the waste? That usually gets left out of the equation. The general consensus seems to be that when you add all of that stuff up, especially waste disposal, the EROI for nuclear is not terrific. I don't know exactly where it is, but my sense is that people are talking in sort of the 8 to 10 range. But it's full of assumptions that can be challenged and debated. Interestingly enough, when it comes to alternative energy sources, the EROIs for solar and wind are actually pretty good. Because they produce for long periods of time after the initial investment. The issue with solar and wind is energy density. You have to have huge arrays of solar panels and huge wind farms to produce the kind of concentrated, high-quality energy that will allow you to run, say, an auto plant or a skyscraper in downtown Chicago or an aluminum smelter at the extreme end of the spectrum. So we can't do it all with renewables, even though their EROIs are fairly good.
There are several other questions that are there. I'm told that we've run out of time locally as well as globally. I will invite the other panelists, if they have a final word, to add to that.
Well, if I had to leave you with one word, it is technology. On every single discipline, from energy efficiency from renewable to technology, from nuclear to clean coal. That's how we're going to win at this. And I think I'm convinced we can. I'm absolutely convinced. It's going to take a massive amount of investments from both the private sector and working partners with government. Again, I want to thank you for inviting me to share my thoughts with you this morning, and I look forward to following up on your 2 days of discussions here. Thank you very again.
Are you okay?
I'll point out one thing with respect to your question on the $5 billion. I think there's probably no more succinct explanation of why it is that from the standpoint of technology, from the standpoint of economics, you have to get the rules changed rather than take it head on. Because none of the discussions of whether it be sequestration or conservation remotely deal with what amounts to doubling the number of consumers. Because particularly if you think about the economic levels normalizing, it's very hard to do anything else. And so I think it's very important that we really do think about things that change the rules of the game rather than just address the problem. Thank you.
May I ask you to join me in thanking our panelists for their real insights?